I think that we as blacks have a profound opportunity at this moment in history to say to Jimmy Carter that we are prepared to take this country in another direction. Someone asked me, Ron, what do you think Jimmy Carter is going to do for us now that we've given him the presidency? And I said, that's not the question. The question is, what do we demand that Jimmy Carter do? First of all, it seems to me that we have to say to Jimmy Carter that we got rid of King Richard. We have defeated King Ford, and you, Jimmy Carter, shall not be another king in this country. You shall not be the imperial king or the imperial president of the United States. You shall indeed be a president within the framework of a democratic society. And since we as black people have made the margin of difference in your election, then we demand that you reject the notion of the imperial presidency, and we demand that you join with us in establishing policies, priorities, practices, and programs that speak to the highest and the best, not only of black America, but all oppressed human beings in our society and around the world. And the degree to which you do not do that, Jimmy Carter, we will make an effort to make your life as miserable as possible over the next 4 years, and we will damn well make it impossible for you to achieve the high office of the presidency 4 years from now. I think that's what politics is all about. I don't think that politics is about trading votes for a handful of jobs in the White House and whether there shall be a black or two blacks in the cabinet. To me, that's never been the politics. That was my concern in New York City when blacks met with Jimmy Carter, and my concern was, what did you meet with him to negotiate? To negotiate a few jobs or cabinet position is absurd. Richard Nixon appointed blacks to the White House. Gerald Ford appointed black to the cabinet. One would expect Jimmy Carter to appoint blacks to the cabinet and put blacks and other minorities and women in the White House. The question is, where are you programmatically? And that disturbs me. And I would like to begin at the level of foreign policy, because I think blacks now have a prime responsibility to shape the direction of foreign policy in the world. And just before I do that, let me back up and pose the question. It seems to me that we have an opportunity to be in the forefront of the struggle to humanitize this country, or we can be just one more group that gets caught up in the status quo of the politics in this country and allow ourselves to be bought off at a very cheap price. I would like to see us opt for the former rather than the latter. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and many others died for our rights. They died challenging this country at a very basic and profound level. And it would seem to me that if we can herald them as great and brilliant, committed and courageous and prophetic human beings, that it means more than us saying to Jimmy Carter, we elected you and we hope that you do something. Our responsibility now has to be to challenge the best in Jimmy Carter and to be an integral part of posing the direction. Southern Africa is looming as one of the most important geopolitical areas in the world, so we now have a prime responsibility in foreign policy. Many of us as blacks were not involved in the peace movement in this country, and I saw that as a very, very serious problem. The peace movement itself made a serious mistake. It focused primarily on America withdrawing from Vietnam rather than withdrawing from the mentality that sees a need to kill and maim as a way of solving human problems. We as black folks now have an opportunity to move into the forefront of the movement to radically alter America's foreign policy. The questions that we must raise with Jimmy Carter, the questions that we must encourage Jimmy Carter to raise, the questions that must be discussed and debated in this country is A, should America continue to be the police officer to the world? B, should America continue to be the number one gun runner in the world? C, should America continue to be the most powerful counterinsurgency force in the world? My answer to all three of those questions is no. I don't believe that in a rapidly changing world that's becoming increasingly smaller and increasingly interdependent, that the United States continues to play the role of police officer to the world, gun runner to the world, with our CIA, DIA, NSA activity going on all over the world. And I'm going to specifically talk about our intelligence community because, as you know, I was the only black person that served on the committee that ostensibly investigated the intelligence community. And maybe if I don't get into it in the course of my remarks, if some of you ask me a question about it, then we can get into it. We presently are spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $113 billion building a monument to military madness. B-1 bombers and Trident submarines, spreading troops all over the world that serve no useful purpose. There's no treaty obligation that dictates our forward deployment of any number of troops around the world, yet we have 319,000 troops in NATO countries. If you add up all the direct and indirect cost of America's support of NATO, it costs us roughly $65 billion per year to maintain our involvement in NATO. That's if you count strategic, tactical, and conventional forces, $65 billion direct and indirect costs. Why do we have 319,000 troops in NATO countries? We have 42,500 troops in South Korea, 666 tactical nuclear weapons. Why? I asked that question of Secretary Schlesinger when he was Secretary of Defense. I said, look, the South Koreans have roughly 600,000 troops who are combat experienced as a result of a recent involvement in Vietnam. The North Koreans, the ostensible enemy, have somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 troops. They have not fired a shot in over 20 years, except occasional sniper fire at the border. What is the justification for our deployment of 42,500 troops to help 600,000 troops combat experience to fight 300,000 troops with no combat experience? The gentleman from California is correct. We can't justify our involvement in South Korea on military grounds, Mr. Dellums. We do it on political grounds. My follow-on question was, what's so sacrosanct about 42,500 troops? It costs us several billion dollars to station those number of troops in South Korea when we desperately need to deal with the human problems in this country and the humanitarian problems of hunger and malnutrition around the world. Couldn't we have 4,250 troops, or 425 troops, or 42.5 troops, or 4.25 troops? Why do we need 42,500 troops? I never got a clear and unequivocal answer. A few weeks back, this country almost went to war around an incident of cutting down a tree. We obviously are concerned about the brutal death of human beings, but when you consider a nation almost going to war because our inability to communicate with another nation is so profound that we could almost go to war around the question of cutting down a tree, it's incredible. I often deal in symbolism, and I picked up the Washington Post one morning, front page, United States, in show of strength, cuts down tree. And that was mind-blowing. You consider a nation engaging in the issue of cutting down a tree. Then in the same newspaper on the editorial page, it was a brilliant cartoon. The sky was dark with American planes, tanks, troops, and two guys are talking, and one of them said, where in the hell are we going? And the other one said, to cut down a tree. And a massive military force. But it points at one level to the absurdity and the insanity of the positions and the posture that we find ourselves in. What should be America's role in the world? Can we continue to spread all these troops around the world? Why do we do it? What is the justification? We have 52,000 troops in the area of Japan and Okinawa. So I asked Secretary Schlesinger, why do we have all these troops? They said, well, you know, Mr. Dellums, Japan is an important refueling spot. And I said, well, 52,000 troops pumping gas has got to be the largest gasoline station in the world. Do we need 52,000 troops? What's so sacrosanct about that number? The answers get very vague. Washington, D.C. and the Pentagon is a scenario factory. Somebody always has this possible scenario, that possible scenario. So that justifies keeping everything the way it is. What if we move this? What if this happens? Or what if that happens? What if the Middle East goes here? What if NATO goes there? We need all these troops. Yet hunger and disease and malnutrition, racism, sexism, classism, age chauvinism, all the crippling problems that harm and maim human beings continue to be real in this country. And we build a monument to the madness of war, pouring money down a rat hole in Virginia known as the Pentagon, in a world that's becoming increasingly smaller and increasingly interdependent. And it doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense to me. And it seems to me that we as blacks now have a profound opportunity to say, we were the margin of difference in this election. We don't want the continent of Africa to become another battlefield, another place where you play chess, where nations become pawns on a giant chessboard and human life hangs in the balance.